icon, Artie Kornfeld, one of the most successful writers in rock history, with over 65 songs on the chart and over 120 platinum records as composer, publisher, producer, performer, manager, and promoter, comes the official memoir and tell-all story of growing up in the culture of American music. From Artie's breakthrough as the first vice president of rock in the music industry, to his collaboration with some of the biggest legends in music, to the building of a nation, the Woodstock Nation. Continuing in the footsteps of his mother, Shirley Kornfeld, who fought segregation by organizing freedom rides in the 1950s and 60s, Artie has been committed to fighting for freedom since childhood. This memoir is a look into the soul of the development of the rock culture through the eyes of someone who has been on the inside from the beginning, through Woodstock 69 and beyond, to a new spirit of the Woodstock Nation.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag, so we bought a pack of cigarettes, and Mrs. Wagner's pies, and we walked off to look for America. Kathy, I said, as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, again seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one, and now look out. So I looked at the scenery. She read the magazines and the I'm lost. Oh, I said, though I knew she was sleeping, I'm empty, I'm aching, and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. They've all come to look for America.
And welcome to the spirit of the Woodstock Nation. Tonight it's more the spirit of America. Tonight it's about the music of the people that make us work. You know, it's not about the people in the penthouses. It's about the people that put their asses on the line and who go out there and protect us and keep us okay. My guest tonight is David LeClaire. David LeClaire, I have a history with, which I'll go into, but to set it up, I'll just start by telling you that David was one of the three people that were flown to Los Angeles to be in the Rose Bowl parade as the heroes of 9/11. And before David, would you say hello?
Hi.
Yeah. By the way, David's also my cousin. Okay? And David is a hero. So to set it up for David to tell the story of what happened on September 11, 2001, since you'll hear from David. I don't even want to talk, but I'm going to play Barry McGuire, The Eve of Destruction, just to set it up because this story is about destruction and about people putting their lives on the line to try to save people that day. So Eve of Destruction and then David for the rest of the show.
Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Yeah, my blood's so mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
About two cousins tonight, and really about my cousin. I'm very proud of David LeClaire. I know that on September 11, I was laying in bed looking at the TV. What I didn't know is that's how my day started. David, what was September 11, 2001? What happened in the world?
On September 11th, I was a police officer assigned to the police academy. At the firearms range, and since we had downtime, There was actually nothing going on, and since it was such a gorgeous day out, I decided to go take a walk outside the academy and start talking to a couple of other police officers. And it just so happened that the academy faces toward the Trade Center. And as I was talking with one of the other cops, I spot this plane traveling south over the Hudson River, very, very low. And I kept watching it, and it kept getting closer and closer to the tower, and then it just slammed into the top of the tower. So I tried calling my partner, who was upstairs at the academy, and I couldn't get through. What I didn't know was that when the plane hit, it cut all the communication wires for cell phones. So I ran over to the academy, finally got my partner. I told him, let's go. They're going to mobilize us because some kind of aircraft had just slammed into the top of the tower. We went back upstairs. We were starting to get our equipment. And all of a sudden, somebody came in and said that there was another plane that just hit the other tower. So I looked at my partner and I told him, I said, this is a terrorist attack. Get your vest. Get all the ammo you can carry, any spare weapons you can get. And I grabbed the keys to my vehicle, and I got as many people as I could into the vehicle, and we got over to the buildings a couple of minutes after the second plane had hit. And we, as a group, we all went into the tower on the bottom floor because all the windows on the bottom had been blown out by the impacts, I guess, from the concussion of the plane slamming in. Well, once I got inside the building, there was a command post up inside there. So I realized that just being a police officer and all this brass running around, I better, you know, get out of the way and just wait for somebody to tell me to do something. So I stood by the windows that I had just come in through, and I was going to tell everybody else to watch because there was stuff falling. And about a couple of minutes later, all of a sudden I began hearing these huge noises, and I turned and looked, and 15 feet away from me were all these people who had been jumping off the building from the top of the Trade Center. They were landing right next to me. And after that, we went into the building. It was like over the top of our boots with water. And I ran into one of the cops from emergency services, and he's one of the cops that died on 9/11, Greg Froner. Anyway, I had made a small pact with my partner that we weren't going to get separated, that we were going to stay together and, you know, get our way through this. And as it turned out, we got separated. So I wound up on one of the floors underneath Trade Center, and I saw there was an FBI agent standing all alone with just a windbreaker on it, and had a little FBI on it. So being that I was a uniformed police officer, I figured try and get all these people out as fast as we could, have a uniform over there, and we'll get them out. And that's what we started doing. I started getting these people out and having everybody, you know, get out from underneath the building, get out any way they could. And all of a sudden, the FBI agent turned to me, and he said, we're tracking a third plane. Well, not knowing what the third plane meant, I figured there was a third plane coming in on top of the two that had already struck the building. Well, all of a sudden now, I began hearing a noise, and all these people were around me. I'm trying to get everybody out as fast as I can, and what I thought was the noise of the third plane kamikazing into the building turned out that it wasn't. It was the first tower beginning to collapse, which I didn't know. So I was wearing my vest, and all of a sudden, as the tower's collapsing, and I guess the pressure and everything underneath it was exploding, I was starting to get pelted with all this stuff in my face. And I knew that I had my vest on, so I turned, I put my back to it, and I figured, you know, I'm protected pretty well. And then I began feeling stuff hitting me, and chunks of my pants were starting to come off. And next thing you know, there was this gigantic explosion. First, it went pitch black. I guess the power had cut out completely. And, I mean, it was so pitch black, you couldn't see anything in front of you. And next thing you know, there was this gigantic explosion. And I got picked up, and I have no idea how far I got thrown, but I slammed into a wall. excuse me. And blew my knee out, blew my elbow out, other various injuries. And then I got pinned to the wall. The concussion from the explosion just had me pinned there. And all of a sudden, within about, I don't know, a few seconds after that, it went absolutely dead quiet. There wasn't a sound anywhere. And being that I knew there were people all around me, I couldn't figure out what was wrong. I thought maybe I was entombed somewhere, because I remember what happened at the first bombing in 93, what happened with that gigantic hole and all these pockets that were all around. That's what I thought. I thought I was in this pocket and I wasn't getting out. So I had a one of our flashlights that we used for training in my pocket. I took it out, and when I flipped it on, I saw absolutely nothing except the little halo at the end of the flashlight, and I could see these brown and black flakes, which I now know is all the soot. And it was very, I mean, I'll never forget that that smell and that taste, and it was just choking. I was choking on this stuff so bad. Well, I kept trying to find out where I was. I was using my free hand to see if anything was hanging down that I was going to run into, and I was using my foot ahead of me, like probing to see if there was a hole in the ground. Well, when I was able to make myself move forward, I started calling out, and I started yelling to people, and I said, if you can hear my voice, come to me. I've got a flashlight. We're going to get out. And I must have said this a dozen times. And all of a sudden, I began hearing some moans. I began hearing people talking. And then I started hearing people in the darkness just start yelling, come this way, come this way, follow his voice. He's got a flashlight. And I kept hearing this all over. And then I began hearing more and more people. And then looked to my left, a guy in a suit showed up in front of me. And it turns out it was a detective. And then as I turned the flashlight just a little bit, all of a sudden there was another person there, and he had a white shirt on. And the detective told me that was either a city inspector or a captain. And then there was more and more people showing up. And with that, with my free hand, I grabbed the detective by his jacket. He grabbed the guy with the white shirt. He grabbed the next guy and the next and so on. So we had this gigantic, like, conga line. So I was the lead, and I had no idea where we were. So I just started walking. And eventually we came to a wall, and now it was just a decision time. Am I going to go right or am I going to go left? Well, we went left. We went right. We went right. And when we came to the end of that wall, I felt that the wall was not blown out. It was a finished wall. So I figured this was a hallway going down to a door or something. And turns out it was the entrance to the subway system. What I didn't know was that there was a gigantic step down into it. So when I took the step into it, I started falling in. The detective thought I was falling into a hole. He grabbed me even tighter, and I grabbed him, and then all of a sudden I hit the ground, and I found out that I was standing on another step. So once we got into the subway system, now I realized that the power was still on because you could see the overhead fluorescent lights were on, and I immediately thought the third rail was on. So if anybody, you know, with all the smoke, they're not going to know it's there. Somebody falls down the tracks and gets electrocuted. So I just started yelling to everybody, put your right shoulder against the wall. Because once I knew where we were, now I knew how we were going to get out. So I had everybody, I stayed there, and I was telling everybody, just go up the stairs, keep the shoulder on the right wall. And they did. And when the last of the people that I knew of were going up, I then went up myself. And as I got up to the first landing, I found a uniformed police officer on the ground. So I said to him, come on. And he goes, I can't. My knee. So I picked him up and I threw his arm over my shoulder and I said, come on, we're getting out of here. And I carried him up the stairs. And when we got up to onto the street, all of a sudden in all that smoke, I realized that I'm choking and I'm having a real hard time breathing. So I started spitting and trying to get all the stuff out. And I noticed that as I'm spitting, it's black. And now all of a sudden the thought ran through my head that something got underneath my vest and punctured me, and I'm spitting up blood. So all of a sudden I realized that it's starting to get a little bit lighter, and I realized this is the soot that was down inside my lungs or whatever it was. So now we're walking a little bit, and all of a sudden I realize that there's somebody in front of me, and I don't know who this person is, but as I'm walking, they're walking, so I figured they're just getting out of there. So made the turn onto Nassau Street and walked up to Broadway. And as we get up to Broadway, I found EMS there, and that's where I turned the uniform officer over to EMS, and then they took care of him. And then a lot of firemen who had been outside the buildings at the time all of a sudden came up and said, here's water. They gave me water, and I was so covered in soot and all kinds of stuff that it was in my ears, it was in my hair. I couldn't see, I couldn't breathe, and I was trying to take all this water and just dump it on my face and down my throat to get rid of all this stuff. So,
David?
Yeah.
David, at this point, let's take a little break so you can think. Just fantastic. I mean, I'm so proud of you. Everybody, David LeClaire is my cousin, and I've been proud of him for so many years. You know, he was proud of me, and yet he never really questioned me about Woodstock and out of his feelings, because what happened after will continue. You know, I really respected and really never asked David really what happened to him until I got a call in L.A., and we'll get to the rest of David's story. Heidi Little just wrote a song. It's called Action Hero. Excuse me. It's called Action Hero. So this is the Woodstock Nation, folks, and this is the spirit of Woodstock. What David had was a spirit that was superhuman, you know, to get through what he got through. And Action Hero. Thank you. about the spirit, only we're not tying it into Woodstock. We're talking about the spirit to survive, which we need in this country right now, the spirit for us to survive. And it happens to be my cousin David. But when David and I talked earlier today, because I never really questioned him thoroughly, I shook for an hour when he told me the whole story. So David, there you were in pieces. You were carrying this guy at the time. What happened?
Well, I wasn't carrying. I had his arm over my shoulder, you know, and I was doing like fireman carrying him out of there. I got him down to Broadway. EMS was there. I turned him over to EMS. And again, firemen were all over the place. EMS was all over the place. And they were passing water out to everybody. And I was trying to take all this water and dump it on my face, dump it in everywhere. I was so hot, and especially since I had my bulletproof vest on, with all this crud that was down and behind me, I was so itchy and I was so hot. I actually felt like I was a sausage inside that thing. It was so hot. Well, anyway, now I'm starting to wander around. I'm trying to find some of my guys, and all of a sudden, somebody starts yelling, "Run north, run north!" And I'm saying, "Well, why are we going to run north?" And from where I was standing on Broadway and Nassau, I looked over the top of the cloud, and I could see the top of Tower 1. And Tower 1, if you remember, had the antenna on it. And all of a sudden, I'd see the top. To me, I thought my eyes were playing a trick on me because I thought I saw the top of the tower move. And not only the top of the tower, but the top of the antenna move. And I said, it can't be. It's got to be. You know, just my eyes. But like everybody else, I started running north, and I was starting to go down Park Row, and next thing you know, there was another gigantic explosion. The sidewalk, the street just like heaved up like it was an earthquake. And I turned around and I look, and here coming up Nassau Street and on Broadway and Park Row was this gigantic cloud of debris, all kinds of junk flying out of it, and I said, I can't outrun that. So I lied down in the street because this thing was just rushing at me. And since I was having such a hard time breathing, I figured if I laid on the ground with my head facing away, it's going to go pack itself up my nose. So I turned with my head into it, and I put my arms over my head, and I said to myself, whatever happened to that first building, it didn't get me. Whatever happened to that second building didn't get me. But I'm lying on the ground now, and there's ambulances, fire engines, police cars running all over the place. I said, I'm going to get run over here because nobody could see anything. Well, it just so happened that as soon as the cloud hit us, everybody just shut off their cars, shut off all their trucks, emergency vehicles, fire engines, everything, and everybody just sat there. And next thing you know, we got pelted again with this cloud and all this debris. So it was a while later, and then I was able to get up on my knees, and I'm looking up, and I can finally start seeing the clouds start dissipating, and I can see the sun coming through a little bit. So now I'm trying to figure out, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? I got to get back and start helping other people. Well, it turns out that I look like, everybody said I look like Frosty the Snowman, but in a brown shade. Well, it turns out that I wound up over in Pace University, and they were real nice over there. They actually broke into their supply of all the water that they had in the cafeteria, and they gave it to all of us, and we were taking them and trying to get all this stuff off of us. But it was like it turned to cement. We couldn't get it off. And my eyes were killing me. My nose was killing me. My throat was killing me. My eyes were killing me. And it turns out that one of the students, a young girl, saw me, and she said, do you want me to put some of these eye drops in your eyes? And I said, oh, you know, would you? So I'm 6'4". She must have been about 5'3". So I had to get down on my knees and bend over backwards so she could take the drops and drop them into my eyes. Well, after a while, after we had enough water and we were getting all this stuff off of us, we went to leave. And at that point, I saw the girl again. And she said, "You want me to put that stuff in your eyes again?" And I said, "Sure." And she did. Well, now we start going outside trying to find what we're going to do. And it turns out that I ran into the detective who I pulled out from underneath the building earlier. And we hook up and we're walking around. We're trying to find anything. We're trying to find our commands. We're trying to find our command centers of what, you know, what's going on. We didn't even know that the towers had come down. I didn't even find that out until later on that night when I was in the hospital. So we're walking around. We went over to one of the hospitals that are in lower Manhattan. I think it was Beekman downtown. Again, they gave us more water. They were trying to take care of us. I was, like, punctured in certain, you know, spots all over me. And they were, like, trying to treat some of that real quick. And then I wound up going on right around the back of City Hall. And I must have been in a daze or something because one of the sergeants said to me, "Officer, you know where you're going?" And I said, "No." So he said, "Well, I would suggest you go over to Chambers Street." And he said, walk westbound on Chambers. So I did. And I found a whole bunch of firemen over on the west side. And I asked them if they knew where our command center was. And they pointed me up the block, which was right by Manhattan College. And it turns out that this is the part I don't remember. The cop who I was talking with, as we watched the first plane go in, happened to be standing outside the command center and the college. He sees me walking up West Street, coated, all white, and he says, "All of a sudden the media swarmed around you, and they had microphones in your face, and they were asking you questions, and it looked like you were answering." And he said he came running in there, he grabbed me, pulled me out of that circle of media, and then they brought me into the triage center where eventually I was evaluated and then sent to the hospital. And that night...
David, let me ask you something. At this point, since your precinct was right next to World Trade Center, really, and you lost, what, 38 out of 200?
Well, we lost 37 police. We lost 37 cops that day. It's the largest loss of law enforcement in a single day in a single incident. There was 343 firemen, 37 Port Authority cops, and 23 NYPD cops that were lost. So there was a total of 403 first responders killed on 9/11.
You had a lot of friends that were in there with you, huh?
Yeah. Yep.
Were you wondering about anybody in particular who you got friendly with?
Well, I didn't know who actually was missing. They had a board when I came into the triage center. I was escorted in by a lieutenant and one of the emergency service cops, and it turns out that they had a board with all the names of all the missing people on the board. So when I was brought in, I didn't know that my name was among the missing. So as soon as I walked through the door, I heard everybody start clapping, people were screaming, you know, hooting, hollering. So I jumped around, I turned around, and I said, "Well, who the hell just came in?" And it turns out that because they had heard that I was missing, now I show up. So I was one less among the dead. So so then, like I said, I wound up in the hospital that night. And when I eventually came back, they then ordered me because when I came back, I had heard on the radio that the two guys that they found, the last two police officers that they found that were in that movie, World Trade Center, John McLaughlin and Will Ameno, that they had located them. So I threw all my stuff down and I was going to go run down into it again. But I was in hospital scrubs. They had taken my uniform off. So I was in hospital scrubs and boots. So a whole bunch of bosses jumped in front of me, and they said, "You are going back to your command." they ordered me back, and they got a radio car, and they sent me back to the range. And well,
what
that's
you
basically
mean?
what happened on that day.
What does a range mean?
The firearms range.
That's where you teach?
Yeah, that's where I taught. That was where I was assigned, was to the firearms range.
Right. You taught weaponry?
Well, I wound up the next morning when I actually woke up, I couldn't move from being blown up and slammed into a wall. I couldn't move physically. I just could not move. So I never even went to work that day on the 12th. But on the 13th, that's when I went back to work. I went down to what everybody calls ground zero. And at that point, it was just months and months and months of being down there digging, finding stuff, pulling things out, pulling remains out, and it turns out that I was contacted by Los Angeles LAPD's what's the equivalent of the widows and what is it called, the Widows and Orphans Fund. They had the same thing over in LA, and they said that they would like me to be on the float for the city of Los Angeles during the Rose Bowl parade and represent the city. Well, I told them that I just couldn't say yes, but I would pass along, if they sent me an email, I would pass it along to our boss, and they may send me, they may send somebody else. I said, I didn't know. But if they did that, then I would do that. And they did. I passed along the note to one of our bosses. He called me back the next day. And he handed it back to me, and he said, they decided that you're going to go. So
now, from your cousin's viewpoint, what you're talking about is, first of all, I had no idea that you were there. And then I believe you called me, and I had no idea that you were in the middle of what I was seeing on TV that had me shaking. I mean, I was shaking. We were so worried about you and the family, you know, about your digging, and it did affect your lungs, didn't it? Because you dug for a long time, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it has affected my lungs. I don't know to what degree. It's affected my lungs. It's affected my throat. It's affected my eyes. I don't know. You know, long term, I have no idea what's going to happen. It's just.
Did they? So they actually at that point they promoted you to detective. Huh?
No, not at that point. It was a little while later. But I was after that I was promoted to detective. But it wasn't immediately.
Yeah, it was something you waited a long time for. My cousin David. I don't know. My cousin David's heritage is his father is Canadian Mohawk. So David is an American, but is also Canadian Mohawk. And his father was one of the chief men in building the Verrazano Bridge, because they all did high steel work. My cousin on that side of the family from David's mother, who's in very bad shape right now, David, and you know how I feel about that, because I don't want to cry. Anyway, when you called me and you said, Artie, I said, where are you, David? And you said, I think you said the Universal Hilton, and I knew that was in L.A., because you had not told me anything about coming to L.A., and, you know, I think within 45 minutes, I drove all the way from where I lived, and there we were, you know, and then the next day, boy, they actually stopped the float, and they had music playing. And I don't know whether it was God Bless America in the background. They had something playing, and they actually stopped the parade and just had the camera on you three guys. And that, I was so proud. I was so proud.
Well, we were on so many TV shows, not actually on the show, but being interviewed in Pasadena before we went on the float. at one of the big firehouses. I don't remember which exact firehouse it was, but it was a big firehouse with a museum in it. And if you went out in front of it, you could actually see the Hollywood sign right up the street. So,
right. You know what, David? To tell you the truth, you know, when I got off the phone, I said to Carol, I said to you on the phone today, David, you always looked at me because I happened so young, and you saw me go down and come up and go down and come up, you know, and I realized that that you were a hero to me. You know, you were, you know, like a lot of people look at me as a hero because of Woodstock, and I said, God, what David went through, David's a hero in our family. You know? And that's when I said, I think this should be shared because people saw 9/11, and sometimes I think people don't realize that these were actually friends and people with families, and these were actually human beings. It wasn't just a TV show, and I guess David, what David just told you, sort of, you know, knows what you already know. I'm just proud of my cousin David. What could I tell you? And David is my friend, so we'll take a break for a minute, and I'm going to play a record I produced with Bert Summers, by the way, called Friends, because I always looked at David not as a cousin, but as a friend.
Count all the friends who would love you today. Get close together, ask them to stay. They're waiting to take you away. They're waiting to take you away for free. Friends understand what you're feeling inside. Take out the laces, leave them untied. They're waiting to take you away. They're waiting to take you away for free. 'Cause they're friends, all your friends, and your friends will always be. If the well runs dry, they'll be standing by till the day you die. You've got your friends. Oh, you've got your friends. And these are the people who followed you down. Break out the good love, pass it around. They're waiting to take you away for free, 'cause they're free.
David.
Yeah.
What's the conclusion of the story for tonight?
Well, the conclusion was it didn't end on that. You know, even at the big parade, it didn't end there. It didn't end. It was just a relief. You know, it needed relief. It didn't end when I attended the concert for New York. That was a great relief. It ended many, many months later on, when it went from a rescue recovery to just a recovery, because at that point they knew there was no way that anybody could be alive down there. And that's what we did. We just continued digging. And then eventually I was just reassigned back to the range because we had lost all our, you know, we lost so many people. And now that terrorism was becoming much more prevalent, and now the people were really aware of it, so now they wanted to start rearming the department, new cops, they had to start new classes. So I was pulled from working down at Ground Zero, and I was sent back to the range to start getting ready to resupply the department and more manpower. So in a nutshell, that's basically my story.
Go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
That was about a year or so after that when, as a police officer, I was assigned to the detective unit to assist. And then a month later, I was promoted to detective. And I've been doing that ever since.
Well, you know, I don't know if I can reveal it, but I called David, and he's in the strangest situations. I don't know if I could reveal them, so I won't. Right, David? But I call David, and he's in fucking, I mean, literally in intense danger, you know, about to be a point guy busting on drug smugglers. I mean, David really is. They are Homeland Security. You know, they really are. They you're looking for Homeland Security. Well, you just heard all about it on 9/11. Yeah, and that's when people realize. Now, my dad being NYPD, which David knows really well, because he, you know, I think he looked up to my father, didn't you?
Huh?
You looked up to my father, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a story, folks. Another story about just a day, right, 9/11, you know, and, you know, it's just something to put in the pocket so you really could appreciate what happened in August of 1969, and you really should be, you know, working to get this country peaceful and back together again. And, you know, fortunately, there hasn't been another one, but it's because of, you know, people like David, you know, that put their ass on the line every time they go to work. And we're talking about really not, like if you put on the Western Channel, Gunsmoke. I mean, it happens in real life, don't it, David?
Yep.
Well, anyway, I want to thank you very much, David, for being on tonight.
Thank you for having me on. I just want, you know, I just hope that people don't actually forget what happened that day and all the lives that were lost and all the pain and it brought to, you know, not just people like me, but to the families and you know, what's going to happen to everybody who knows how many years down the road.
Right. Do you think of the other 40 the 40 guys from your precinct? I mean, you know, I mean one quarter of your friends were killed. You know, do you think back to that? Because it did affect you, you know, for a while. You know, you're coming around, but as I've talked,
I think about it every day. I think about it every day. Something else happens, and I think about it. And there's always something that reminds me about 9/11 every day. You hear a name, you hear a song, you know. Music, as you know, music is a very big part of my life, too. And it just so happens that I associate music with certain events in my life. So, yeah. Does it affect me? It affects me. Will it continue to affect me? I assume it will.
Well, you know what? I've seen it in you, but you know what? You never change with me at all. You're still the same exact way as you were when we talked 10 years ago and 12 years ago and 15 years ago. You're still my cousin, David, and I'm very proud of you.
I'm proud of you, too. And, you know, being cousins, that's what it's all about.
Right. You know, we are all part of the family of mankind, and we should help each other through, and that's what you did. So with that, I will close with something based on the whole conversation, which I've closed with before, and that's Hold the Light by Burt Summers. So everybody out there, keep the spirit of Woodstock alive. Remember what happened on 9/11, because it could happen again, you know, watch who you vote for, you know, but at least be part of the system and show that you care. And everybody, You know, keep the spirit and hold the light. Thank you, David.
All right, thanks for having me.
It's a place where your mind is free. If you've seen it, better keep it. Don't let go. Hold the light. It's so bright. I can't describe it, but it's right and easy to find it. Hold the light. And I know what I want to do. I can try to enlighten you.